because biotechnology as a sector is helping all of us. I'm very optimistic that that sector in particular is going to experience a lot of growth.
Welcome to the new episode of the Scalable Capital Podcast, this time in English. The reason is that today we take a look across the Atlantic Ocean, to be precise, to the Nasdaq Stock Exchange located in New York City, to find out what will be the upcoming trends in tech and beyond. I will talk about this to Mark Marex, Research and Development Specialist with Nasdaq Global Indexes. Welcome, Mark.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Yes, great to have you in our podcast. Mark, in 2020, the Nasdaq saw 316 IPOs raising around $80 billion. 2021 started with 91 IPOs in January and more than 100 in February. March is still running while we are talking. And when you sum up the first quarter so far, which major developments and trends do you see in the IPOs taking place so far? And what do you think we can expect in the next months?
Yeah, great question. So just for starters, historically, right, in the US, SPACs used to be no more than about 20 to 25% of IPOs prior to last year. So last year, they represented more than half of all U.S. IPOs. So far this year, it's three quarters. It's like 77%. And in terms of value, the difference is even bigger. So it used to be about $10 billion a year in value raised by U.S. SPACs. Last year, it was $83 billion. And actually this year, as of mid-March, we've actually already exceeded the total raised for last year, which itself was a record more than six times the previous annual record. So it's a really unprecedented flow of deal volume through this structure. From what I can tell, there is at least an additional $30 billion of SPAC IPO kind of pending in the pipeline. And yes, you know, so far this year, when you compare the SPACs versus traditional operating companies that are IPOing, the value raised by SPACs is about three times the amount of the traditional IPOs. So really, really exceptional kind of environment for raising money in this type of structure. Typically, you have seen SPACs require about 2 years for investors to give them a target to find to merge with. Those deals have been getting done much faster, right? A month, a couple months, 3 months, maybe on average over the past year. So that's keeping costs low for the end investors, lower than average. And that's kind of just adding momentum to people kind of continuing to do these deals. And, you know, we don't know, frankly, how much longer it's going to go on. At NASDAQ, we're getting ready to do our first really big direct listing with Coinbase in April. That company might be valued at close to $100 billion. That's a segment of the IPO market that the New York Stock Exchange has kind of been owning the last couple of years, most of the big deals there. And that's another kind of new segment of the IPO market that really didn't exist prior to a few years ago, and is all part of, I think, this trend of, you know, especially tech companies, especially Silicon Valley kind of venture capital funded companies, looking beyond the traditional IPO process with the big Wall Street banks and trying to paint themselves as kind of democratizing finance, going straight to the retail investor, going straight into the market and kind of bypassing, you know, the traditional finance ecosystem. So I think it's all kind of consistent with trends that we've seen over several years building. But certainly the last year, you know, liquidity has just been plentiful all over the equity and even other asset class markets. And I think that's really helping fuel the SPAC craze right now.
One more detailed question regarding the SPACs. At the moment, a SPAC has its IPO. The target is not yet revealed and not yet clear. What in which sectors do you expect most of the SPACs to find their target?
Yeah, that's a good question. It really depends, because there are SPACs that, even though they don't say a specific target, they say which sector of the economy they want to invest in. So we've seen a number of SPACs recently focus on the kind of consumer space. There have also been, you know, a number of SPACs come out that are focused on the kind of EV, right, the electrical vehicle or green energy space. I think the advantage with SPACs for some of these companies, right, that end up being targets is the level of disclosure is lower. The standards for a company becoming public through a SPAC process are lower. And so for some of these new economy new economy sectors, you can have a company that doesn't have earnings or doesn't even have revenues yet, but simply has a very solid, you know, set of intellectual property and a business plan, and they can come to market and go public much sooner via this process. And that's, I think, where you're seeing a lot of the kind of unique deals happen that wouldn't happen through a traditional IPO or even through a direct listing type of process.
And when we now look at the non-SPAC IPOs that happened so far this year, where do most of the companies stem from? Which sectors do they belong to?
So, yeah, I mean, as I mentioned, we have Coinbase was supposed to have its direct listing with NASDAQ in this month of March. They've pushed it back to April. For folks who don't know, they're sort of the largest cryptocurrency exchange operator and are diversifying into other kind of business areas within the cryptocurrency industry. That's going to be a big one. I know that there were some recently, I think Coupang from South Korea did their IPO on the New York Stock Exchange. That was a very big deal, a kind of e-commerce type of listing. And then the big one for us recently, it wasn't this year, it was late last year, was Airbnb, right? Which I think on its own is valued at more than the top three or top five, I don't remember the exact number, internet travel sites like Expedia and Booking. Really just a tremendous growth story with Airbnb, even despite the pandemic, right? In many ways, the pandemic actually helped their growth story, because people got afraid of doing international travel and going to big crowded hotels and resorts, and found a much better proposition to go rent out, you know, a private residence. And Airbnb is by far the market leader. So at NASDAQ, we're very happy that they decided to list with us.
NASDAQ is often called the tech stock exchange, in German, the Technologiebörse, although there are not only tech companies listed. However, today the technology sector has a weight of 47% in the NASDAQ Composite Index, while consumer services are at 19%, healthcare at 10%. And when we take a closer look, there is also more tech behind the surface. What do I mean with that? We have tech-based business models and companies that are not classified as tech companies. For example, Amazon is consumer services, but tech-based. You mentioned Airbnb is a finance company in the classification system, but is also a lot tech-based. So when we look at this, what can we expect? Will the tech sector, in a narrow sense, grow stronger in the coming years, or will tech outside the tech classification grow stronger? What do you expect?
That's a great question. And actually, we just published a very long research paper looking at the last 20 years in the NASDAQ 100 index. And one of the findings there was that the weight of the tech sector within the NASDAQ 100, and this is also true for the NASDAQ composite, the broader index, the weight has remained very, very stable between about 50 to 60%, no matter what. And that's a function of a couple different factors. One is the fact that you have the really successful, older kind of original NASDAQ tech companies like Apple, like Microsoft, that have just grown very big recently and are very stable. And then you have a lot of the newer companies like Facebook, like Google, that, you know, like Amazon, right? Some of the newer companies, they sound like tech, like you mentioned, but they actually fall into these other categories like consumer services. Even a company like Tesla technically falls into consumer goods. So, you know, we don't expect the future to change all that much. I think from a strict sector classification, it will continue to be around 50, maybe as high as 60%. Tech and, you know, if anything, the consumer part of it will continue to grow a little bit more, because there are just, you know, there continue to be new opportunities for, startups, and even legacy companies to, you know, find ways to use technology to deliver consumer products and services, in a way that is, you know, technologically oriented. And really goes along with the tradition of NASDAQ to attract companies that are younger, that are more innovative and have a focus on innovation and research and development and doing things in a different way.
When we look at other sectors and regarding where the companies come from that now had their IPOs, which sectors can we expect to shrink and grow in the coming 5 to 10 years?
Yeah, so I think within tech, there is still a lot of room for software as a subsector to continue growing. You know, the line in the U.S. about software is that software is eating the world. It's where you see the most disruption happening, especially now that cloud infrastructure has gotten really built up, thanks to companies like Amazon and Microsoft, IBM, and a couple others. You have this whole new way of delivering software as a service, and enabling people to launch products that are purely purely online, purely internet based, as opposed to, you know, the prior way of doing things where you would go to a store and you would buy software on a disk, or even more recently, you would just download software one time on your computer from a website. I think nowadays people recognize that software is the central component to modern technological innovation. And I'll add one to that, which is semiconductors, which is an older sector. It's also been around for about 50 years. Intel was the first big name, also listed on NASDAQ, one of the first companies about 50 years ago. But semiconductors, even though it's an older subsector, has become extremely, extremely important to all the devices, right? All the devices that we use on a daily basis, not just computers, but smartphones, automobiles more and more, things like gaming consoles and tablets. It's everything that has, you know, an internet connection basically requires many, many different types of semiconductors. Depending on what you're using the device to do, there's tremendous growth happening in that sector, subsector as well. So those would be my two that I would really, really highlight.
And the NASDAQ recently launched a new index. It's called the NASDAQ Next Generation 100 Index. And its constituents are the next 100 biggest companies below the companies listed in the NASDAQ 100. Now, NASDAQ decided to call this index the Next Gen. What does this tell us? Does it mean that some of the constituents of this index will be the leading companies in the NASDAQ 100, let's say in 3, 5, or 10 years? Or what do you intend with this naming?
Absolutely, that's right. The index methodology is pretty much the same as the NASDAQ 100. It is really meant to be an extension, a complement to the NASDAQ 100. We just take the next 100 largest companies listed on the NASDAQ exchange, and exclude any financial companies, any banks, brokerage houses, insurance, things like that. And when we look at the history, we see at least over the past 10 years where we did the back test for the index, there were 34 companies that are now in the NASDAQ 100 that were at some point in the historical simulation part of the Next Gen 100. So absolutely, we expect a large chunk of the current Next Gen 100 to eventually make it into the NASDAQ 100. On average, we've seen about six constituents per year graduate, get moved up from the Next Gen 100 to the NASDAQ 100 going back to 2010.
Now, when we compare the NASDAQ 100 to the next gen, we see in the next NASDAQ 100, we have a tech sector with now a weight of 55%. In the next gen, it's only 31%. So I think many of us cannot think about a world in the future where tech will not have the important role it has today. But when we now look that the next gen index has a much lower weight in tech, what does this tell us?
So I'm not sure how much it tells you about the future. What's interesting about the Next Gen 100 is because the range of company size is so much smaller, right? You don't get the really big companies in the NASDAQ 100. And then once you go to company number 200, it's not that much smaller than company 101. So you have a lot less concentration in the index from an individual company perspective. You will never see one company have more than 4% of the weight of the total index. The biggest companies recently have been around 3% at most, versus in the NASDAQ 100, they can get as large as 12, 13, 14% even. We've seen in the case of names like Apple and Microsoft. So, you know, part of it is that the story about you don't have individual companies making up such a big percentage and driving the technology sector percentage up above 50%. The other part of it is that, you know, I think in some of these other sectors like healthcare, like industrials, it's just more difficult for these companies to become as large as an Apple or a Microsoft or a Google or a Facebook. And so there's more of them. And together they can make up a more substantial percentage. Now, does that mean that the healthcare percentage in the NASDAQ 100 will not go up in the future? It very well might. It's been higher historically. It's one of the few sectors that today is actually quite low in the NASDAQ 100 versus historically, because of the growth in the consumer sectors. But, you know, that's not to say that that won't reverse in the future. I think what we can say confidently is that because of the way the Next Gen 100 index is designed and the size of the companies within it, we expect the sector concentration to also be lower and be more diversified there.
At the moment, the biggest holdings are like Viacom CBS, that's the owner of the Paramount movie studios, Roku, who produce streaming devices, and CrowdStrike, a company involved in information security. Are those three biggest constituents typical for what is in the index? Can you maybe give some figures about what characterizes the companies in the Next Gen index?
Yeah, so it's a pretty broad range. I would say that they definitely do tend to lean younger and more tech, more growth oriented on average. But that's not to say that there isn't a nice diverse mix of companies in the index. Like I said, because the companies in some of the other sectors just don't get as large in terms of market cap these days as some companies in tech or consumer do, you have this healthier mix of companies. Maybe healthier is not even the right word, just more diversified. So if you look within industrials, for example, there are four companies in the Next Gen 100 that are in trucking and transportation services. These are not tech companies. They're not new companies. They've been around for a long time, but they just happen to list with NASDAQ and be in that size component that gets them in this index. We also have four companies in the energy and utility space that, even when you think of those sectors as being less innovative, older sectors, actually all four of these companies, names like First Solar, Solar Edge, Enphase Energy, Sunrun, they're all in that renewable and alternative energy space. You can also think of them in a way as being technology, even though they're not classified exactly like technology companies. Within healthcare, you have a very healthy mix of pharmaceuticals, as well as biotech. And you have a couple also international companies in AstraZeneca and in Sanofi. These are European pharmaceutical giants that happen to have American depository receipt, secondary listings in the U.S. on the NASDAQ exchange. Actually, you have quite a bit of international representation in this index, partly from the ADR feature, the fact that, if you're listed on NASDAQ and your listing size is within that range, you can get into the index. So my basic, kind of summary answer is it's quite diversified. Even though it leans more towards the younger, innovative companies, you will still see some of the older sectors, especially in industrials, in consumer. You have some of the older media companies. You have some of the older travel companies, even a few hotels and airlines, mixed in with the fast-growing newer companies that are, let's be honest, more likely to end up in the NASDAQ 100 at some point.
You already mentioned the healthcare sector a couple of times and mentioned some companies. In the Next Gen Index, the healthcare sector takes like 18%, in the NASDAQ 100, 6%. Recently, we of course had a big focus on healthcare related to the corona crisis. This will hopefully vanish in the time to come. But apart from corona, do you see healthcare growing or shrinking or staying the same?
So I think this is one of the most interesting questions from a sector perspective. When I was doing some research on our biotechnology index last year, a lot of what I was finding was kind of historical support for this idea that because biotechnology as a sector is helping all of us with the coronavirus pandemic, not just the treatment, but also the vaccination. And of course, we have in Germany, BioNTech, which also is one of those examples that has a secondary listing in the US with NASDAQ, interestingly enough. I think there's a very strong argument you can make that there will be increasing investor funds flowing into the industry, and there will be increasing government support in terms of potentially, being more receptive to lowering some regulatory hurdles in terms of getting new products approved. And in general, just looking at the sector as being a real kind of partner to humanity as opposed to just another place of business, I think there's a tremendous growth opportunity from that perspective, and also from the perspective of it's one of the sectors that has been lagging in terms of adopting new technology. There's a huge pipeline of technological innovation, especially in things like genetics, where we are just starting to see the early impacts of how it's going to allow us to develop new drugs, new treatments, new therapies in a much faster and cheaper fashion in the coming years. I'm very optimistic that that sector in particular is going to experience a lot of growth. It's unclear to me if companies in that sector will get as large as Apple or Microsoft. Maybe not. But I think the reason the percentage weight is larger in the Next Gen 100 is because you're seeing a lot of those faster growing smaller names really start to find success in biotechnology specifically.
When we focus on the healthcare companies, especially in the Next Gen Index, are there like some main focuses most of those companies deal with?
Yes. So I think there's a few different ways of looking at it. One is the traditional pharmaceutical lens, right? So the names like AstraZeneca and Sanofi that are part of the index, those are much bigger companies than the typical company in the Next Gen 100, and they're only in the index because of the secondary listing in the U.S. and how much smaller that listing is than the main listing. But if you think about pharmaceuticals, right, the idea is that their clinical trials, their drug developments, will start to make use more of new technologies like artificial intelligence, like machine learning, to basically help them run clinical trials faster, more efficiently, more cheaply, and have fewer failures. And that can both bring treatments faster to market as well as reduce the cost, right? Reduce the cost to produce and reduce the cost to the end consumer. So we see that technological impact featuring very strongly in the pharmaceutical sector. Now, in biotechnology, it's a totally different consideration because of things like, you know, the vaccinations, the things that companies like BioNTech and Moderna are doing with mRNA, a totally new approach to vaccinations. That is core biotechnology. That is not, you know, pharmaceuticals and kind of doing clinical trials with pills or with other kind of treatments like that. And then there's the whole, as I mentioned earlier, kind of phase of genetics, right? People finding ways to cure cancer and other diseases by doing things like gene therapy or gene editing, which is just a completely, totally different field of medical research that has its own unique, technological inputs to be able to test and actually deliver something like that. So these are all kind of different areas within healthcare that I see technology in the next decade. I think just as it transformed a lot of the older consumer businesses, consumer retail, and moved it into e-commerce, I see a lot of change happening in the next decade in all of these kind of different subsectors of healthcare as a result of the technological progress that has been made over the past 10 or 20 years.
So one takeaway for everybody who watches the markets and is thinking about where to invest is maybe the technology sector in a narrow sense will not grow that much bigger, but technology will also be a stronger part of the healthcare sector.
That's right. I think there are very few parts of the economy today that are not impacted by technology. So even if you are looking outside of the traditional tech sector classification, you mentioned it earlier today, NASDAQ is thought of as a tech exchange and the indexes are thought of as tech indexes. They're really not. They're about 50% at most. Kind of traditional technology when you think about things like software, like semiconductors and other hardware, and internet technology, right? And then there's the whole other sphere of influence that technology has, whether it's fintech on financial services, whether it's biotechnology on healthcare, whether it's e-commerce on retail and consumer goods, or whether it's internet technology impacting things like travel, and the fact that we can, you know, we don't need travel agents anymore. We can book all the travel ourselves, and we also don't need to stay at hotels. We can stay at an Airbnb. So the impact is broad. I think very few sectors will end up looking like they did 10 or 20 years ago, in the near future, you will have in every sector, basically, this kind of mixture of the old and new.
Now, when we think about what do the developments we talked about in the end mean for individual investors, I mean, one thing is if you invest in the NASDAQ 100 or in the next gen and you use an ETF, you always take part in the general development. So if there are some sector shifts, the index in the ETF automatically have them kind of built in. Now, if you decide, do I invest into the NASDAQ 100 or in the next gen? What did your backtest show? Was there were there bigger returns in the next gen or in the 100?
So when we look at the backtest, the returns of the NASDAQ Next Gen 100 are very, very close. Not quite as good as the NASDAQ 100 because the past decade has just been just completely blown away pretty much every other large global index benchmark. But from what I can tell looking at the latest numbers, go back to the beginning of the backtest date in December of 2009 up through the end of February of this year. On a price return basis, the Next Gen 100 would have returned 549%. So not bad at all, from a returns perspective. And again, given that it is tends to be less concentrated from an individual component perspective, as well as from a sector perspective, I think it's a very, very nice story to talk about that index as a real compliment. I just looked at the NASDAQ 100 returns over the same period, 614% from a price perspective. So a little bit higher, but not much, much higher. They are very, very similar, at least from what we can tell so far from a performance perspective.
Okay, and regarding the risk and volatility?
So far, they are pretty similar. The Next Gen 100 is going to be a little bit more volatile at times because of the fact that some of the names are smaller, and maybe earlier in their growth stage, right? If you think of the NASDAQ 100, it's more of a mature growth index, whereas the Next Gen 100 is more of a mid-cap growth index. So definitely at times it may be a bit riskier, it may be a bit more volatile, depending, I think, more on market sentiment and how the market prices in the risk of investing into earlier growth stage companies. But overall, we do not see it being, on average, a substantially riskier index than the NASDAQ 100.
So, Mark Marex, thank you very much for your insight into what is happening in the IPO space at the NASDAQ, what we can expect from several sectors from healthcare to tech to happen, and also about the information about the indexes, NASDAQ 100 and NASDAQ Next Gen. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to be here, and I hope everyone enjoyed the podcast.
Yes, I hope our listeners can take away something from it for their personal investment. So I say goodbye and hope we can welcome you soon to our next episode in the Scalable Capital Podcast.
Scalable Capital Vermögensverwaltung GmbH erbringt keine Anlage-, Rechts- und oder Steuerberatung. Sollte dieser Podcast Informationen über den Kapitalmarkt, Finanzinstrumente und oder sonstige für die Vermögensanlage relevante Themen enthalten, so dienen diese Informationen ausschließlich der Erläuterung der erbrachten Dienstleistungen. Die Kapitalanlage ist mit Risiken verbunden. Bitte beachten Sie hierzu die Hinweise auf unserer Internetseite.